Welcome to our podcast, "'Tis But a Scratch, Fact and Fiction About the Middle Ages." I'm your host, Professor Richard Abels, my co-host, partner for life, and inspiration for all things medieval is my wife, Ellen.
And today, Richard and I will be talking with Professor Barbara York of the University of Winchester in the UK.
This is the second episode of a three-part series on King Alfred the Great of Wessex, the only English king to be called the Great. In the previous episode, I provided an overview of Alfred's reign and the development of the cult of Alfred the Great in 18th and 19th century Britain, culminating in the 1901 millenary celebration. In that episode, I also explain why I think Alfred deserves to be called the Great. If you don't know much about Alfred, you might want to listen to that episode before listening to this one.
We'll be here when you finish. But maybe you can give the listeners a brief synopsis.
Well, I do nothing briefly. Just ask my frustrated editors. But here goes. Alfred was king of the West Saxons between 871 and 899, a period during which much of Britain was beset by Viking raiding and invasion. Wessex in 871 was the most powerful kingdom in southern Britain. Its kings ruled all of England south of the River Thames from Cornwall to Kent. Alfred's claim to fame is that he defeated the Vikings. While the other English kingdoms of Britain fell to the Danish invaders, Alfred's Wessex not only remained independent, but Alfred was able to extend his authority over what had been Western Mercia. The reason that I think he deserves to be called the Great is not because of his decisive victory over the Danes in the Battle of Edington in 878, but because of how he followed it up. Recognizing the deficiencies of the military system he inherited, Alfred reformed the West Saxon army from an ad hoc levy of landowners into a mounted standing army. He had fortified towns built along all of the kingdom's lines of communication and required landowners to provide garrison troops for each. What especially impressed the Victorians is that Alfred played naval architect and had a small royal navy constructed based upon his own ship designs. And on top of all of that, he sponsored a revival of learning and religion in Wessex that included the establishment of a court school and a program of translation of works from Latin into Old English. Alfred was never King of England, but his reforms laid the foundation for his West Saxon successors to create the Kingdom of England. He himself remained King of Wessex, but although he never assumed the title King of Mercia, his victory at Edington left him in control over Western Mercia. He expressed this by taking a new royal title in his coinage and charters, King of the Anglo-Saxons, which is literally true, as he was now King of the Anglian Mercians and King of the Saxon West Saxons. Meanwhile, the Alfredian Renaissance elevated the vernacular Old English into the language of Anglo-Saxon government and literature.
Okay, brief. Not bad.
I'd add one more thing. In Alfred's Old English translation of Boethius's The Consolation of Philosophy, which, despite doubts expressed by some of my colleagues, I believe is Alfred's own work, he added some thoughts about power and authority that aren't in the original. Quote, "You know that desire for the possession of earthly power never pleased me overmuch, and that I did not unduly desire this earthly rule. To speak briefly, I desired to live worthily as long as I lived, and to leave after my life to the men who should come after me the memory of me in good works." End quote. I think he deserves to be called the Great because he did precisely that.
Okay. Can we now contact Professor York and find out what she thinks about all this?
We are pleased to have as our special guest, Professor Barbara York. I can think of no better person to assess the accomplishments and reputation of King Alfred than Barbara York, Emeritus Professor of Early Medieval History at Winchester University. Barbara is the author of several excellent books and many articles about politics and religion in Anglo-Saxon England. Her Wessex in the Early Middle Ages is essential reading for those interested in King Alfred and the kingdom he ruled. Barbara and I share the distinction of being among the host of biographers of King Alfred.
Her Alfred the Great, published by the History Press in 2015, is a very good, as well as a very short, introduction to the man and the sources for his reign.
It is very short, isn't it, compared to Richard's?
but it's very incisive.
Barbara, welcome to the podcast, 'Tis But a Scratch, Fact and Fiction About the Middle Ages.
I was delighted that you had agreed to do this. I was simply a history major and then went to law school, but you know, I've been happily reading from my husband's library and enjoying your works for many years.
Nice to meet you, however remotely.
Yes, and one of the things I liked most about your very short history of Alfred is how incisively you talked about how his reputation changed over the ages.
Yeah.
Beginning, of course, with, I always thought that in one odd respect, he resembled Winston Churchill. I know how I shall be remembered in history because I intend to write it. Yes. Yes. And that does seem to be, Alfred wanted to shape how he would be remembered.
And was pretty successful in shaping.
He was. I mean, that is the thing that makes him stand out and makes him very difficult to put in the context of other Anglo-Saxon
Which
rulers.
Which is the question I'm going to be asking you. Now, Alfred is the only English king, if we're willing to accept that he's an English king, is the only English king to have the title The Great, the only one to be known as The Great. So my question for you is, how deserved is this title? How great was Alfred really?
Well, of course, the thing about this title is that it's very late. It's bestowed on Alfred very late, isn't it? 16th, 17th, 18th centuries, really only in the 18th century that people refer to him quite frequently as the Great. So it's not like Charles the Great, Charlemagne, the great Frankish
king. Almost immediately, Einhard.
Yeah, who was called that after his reign. So really, Alfred to his contemporaries didn't seem that different from other West Saxon kings.
No. Arguably, Alfred's son, Edward the Elder, his grandson Athelstan, and his great-grandson Edgar, the peacekeeper, were more prominent after the conquest.
Yeah, and I would go back further and say Alfred's own grandfather Egbert and his father Ethelwulf were pretty amazing kings as well. Especially, I mean, Egbert really turned round the fortunes of the family. And it's very odd, in fact, that we don't know more about him, that Alfred didn't record more about him, but that's another story, really.
Well, so it fits into this. It fits into what you've been saying, that each generation had almost it was in their interest to minimize the memory, to minimize the accomplishments of their forebears in order to maximize their own, as long as they were of unquestioned lineage.
I think you're right. I think, you know, possibly with Egbert, there were other people descended from Egbert still around in Alfred's time, but who weren't descended from his father, you know, Alfred's own father. So he might have other relatives who shared his grandfather, and perhaps he didn't want to remind people that they existed.
Hmm.
That is interesting.
So Alfred has been celebrated. I mean, he's a Victorian idol.
He is.
As you so beautifully pointed out, I mean, even it's not the epigraph, but the quotation that starts your book is about Alfred as the perfect person in all of history.
And that was the judgment of the great Whig historian Edward Freeman. It was also the opinion of Charles Plummer, in his 1902 biography of Alfred, compared him favorably to Marcus Aurelius, Charlemagne, King Edward I of England, and St. Louis of France.
Oh, give me a break.
The other kings were great but flawed. Alfred, on the other hand, quote, is one of the very few rulers whose work in life and whose memory after death have been an unmixed blessing to their peoples, end quote. There really was a Victorian cult of Alfred the Great, father of the English nation and the British Empire. Singing that choir was Lord Rosebery, former Prime Minister and leader of the Whig Party, who said of Alfred at the unveiling of the Winchester statue in 1901, quote, In him, indeed, we venerate not so much a striking actor in our history as the ideal Englishman, the perfect sovereign, the pioneer of England's greatness, end quote.
Yeah.
Another voice raised in praise of Alfred belonged to the once famous Victorian man of letters, Sir Walter Besant, who envisioned him as, quote, the typical man of our race. Call him Anglo-Saxon, call him American, call him Englishman, call him Australian. The typical man of our race at his best and noblest, end quote.
Our race? I can understand why some students and faculty at Alfred University didn't want a statue of King Alfred at their school.
And why many academics have jettisoned the term Anglo-Saxon for its racialist connotations, and why white nationalists have appropriated it. But as I said in the earlier episode, 19th century and 21st century racial politics has nothing to do with the historical Alfred or Anglo-Saxon England.
Just as well.
But yeah. What I find to be the summary of what the Victorian idea of his accomplishments were is that inscription at the base of the statue in Wantage that was erected in 1877.
Perhaps we could go through it line by line and you could comment on each.
Alfred found learning dead and he restored it.
I mean, is that true or is this exaggerated?
I think that's probably a bit exaggerated because I think there are always learned people in the church. But I do think Alfred might have been rather unusual in being a king who was interested in learning. I think in that respect, he's unusual. But I think in terms of the country as a whole, it wasn't as bad as Alfred perhaps made out himself.
Oh, and he did. He did that. In the preface to his translation of Gregory the Great's Pastoral Care, Alfred wrote, "Often it has come to my mind what men of learning there were formerly throughout England, both in religious and secular orders, and how there were happy times when throughout England, and how the kings who had authority over the people obeyed God and his messengers, and how they not only maintained their peace, morality, and authority at home, but also extended their territory outside, and how they succeeded both in warfare and in wisdom, and how people from abroad sought wisdom and instruction in this country, and how nowadays, if we wish to acquire these things, we would have to seek them outside. Learning had declined so thoroughly in England that there were very few men on this side of the Humber who could understand their divine services in English, or even translate a single letter from Latin into English. And I suppose that there were not many beyond the Humber either. There were so few of them that I cannot recollect even a single one south of the Thames when I succeeded to the kingdom." Asser praises Alfred as "my lord Alfred the truth-teller," but I think here Alfred may be stretching the truth a bit.
Yeah, that's right. That's right. Yeah. I mean, that can't just be the case. And the people who are recording Alfred are all people who are learned, more learned than him, and able to write it down. And as you suggested, I sort of shaped him to be the perfect king. So,
but is part of it simply that the virtues that the 18th and 19th century biographers praised in Alfred were not considered to be as important or as heroic virtues as his contemporaries thought them?
Well, I think that's a very good comment. Yeah, I think they did see different things from contemporary Anglo-Saxons, so who would probably thought it a bit weird if Alfred was interested in learning to read and things like that.
It's interesting because his reputation seems to be in the Middle Ages, not Alfred the Great, but Alfred the Wise.
That's very true.
Because of those.
Yeah. That's very much. In Oxford University in the Middle Ages, taking up Alfred as their founder. I don't know how much is that already because he was Alfred the Wise, but it certainly emphasized that aspect of Alfred. And it is interesting that was his nickname, as it were, before he became the Great. He was the Wise.
And I know that Patrick Warmold had told me that he had been planning to write a biography of Alfred, which would de-emphasize the military and would emphasize Alfred as intellectual and spiritual.
Right. Well, obviously one can do that with those writings that exist, but the the $100 question is, you know, is this really what Alfred thought, or is it what his scholars who he recruited, is it what they thought? You know, how much did he own what they said?
It sounds as though he owned, you described him as a micromanager, and I find it hard to believe that he would have permitted anything to be written about him that didn't meet with his approval. I mean, yeah, he doesn't seem to be someone who trusted his subordinates very much.
I like the image in Asser of Alfred going to lecture his goldsmiths, his falconers, his doorkeepers, his huntsmen on the finer aspects of their craft. The guy was a micromanager.
Yeah.
So we continue. Yeah. Education neglected, and he revived it. That's obviously referring to the school, this court school.
Yeah. Well, it may well be that he did set up a court school that was better than anything that had been there before. But on the other hand, they're already places where people could be educated.
Yes.
And he was expecting his Reeves and Eldermen to be learned enough to be able to read. And I'm not sure how he was able to maybe put that into effect, but I think that was an aim of his.
Yeah. I mean, so people might have learned if they wanted to get on with Alfred that they should be seen cultivating their the learned arts and sort of having people read to them or even read things themselves. But it would be, but on the other hand, you know, there are signs that lay people were able to read in the early Middle Ages. Perhaps it's something that Asser, who says that wasn't used to in Wales, but it might have been commoner in England.
And again, one of the points you made, the estals that he had made, I mean, if one of them winds up in northern Norway with, what was the name, Ordlof, then these are, it sounds as though instead of giving people armbands or brooches or gold tokens as I am an open-handed lord, he simply adapted that by throwing in estals.
El, we should point out to the audience that an astel is an ornate pointer for reading a manuscript.
And given people who he had no reason to believe could read, and people to whom he certainly wasn't giving books, he was sort of like branding literacy as, I mean, what was the point? You know, my followers are literate?
No, I think that's the point, that literacy to Alfred was important because literacy is the foundation of wisdom. Wisdom is the foundation of good government. You can't have these without each other. And I think that in a sense, this isn't a new enterprise. It's new for the Anglo-Saxons, but it's very Carolingian.
Yeah. I mean, that's really the key to Alfred's court, isn't it? That's it's the Carolingian influences becoming more apparent in England. But I wouldn't say Alfred's court was the only route that they're coming in. You know, I think they've been dripping in for, you know, since the time of Offa, and Alfred's father, Ethelwulf, had a Frankish secretary. So, and he was married to a Frankish princess. Yeah. So I suspect, again, it's sort of something that's been gradually building up in the country and at the royal court, and it's being focused, our knowledge of it is focused on Alfred. But, you know, it may be that Alfred himself is a sign of someone who's been brought up in this sort of atmosphere that was established a bit before its reign.
That makes perfect sense.
Okay, we go on with the inscription. He found the laws powerless, and he gave them force.
How about Alfred as lawgiver? How should we assess him as a lawgiver?
Either both as someone who is promulgating laws and someone who might actually be trying to apply and enforce them, which I gather were two different things at the time.
Yeah, well, again, he's building on an existing tradition of lawgiving, and explicitly says he's putting existing laws into an appendix of his own laws, so he's sort of adding to them. Yeah. I mean, they're very traditional, the laws, in some ways, aren't they?
They really
are. Still, you know, they're, you know, you lop off somebody's ear and you have to pay so much, and it's he's not uprooting the whole system.
I did want to ask, how much did enforcement of this law system depend on the energy of the king and how much of it was enforced at the shire or even hundred level? I mean, are these supposed to be just customary laws, as like you had customary laws in Iceland without any higher authority?
I think a lot of them did operate like that, and that's how the local courts worked, that depended upon a build-up of knowledge over the years and local people who knew the law. But obviously there are some cases, some people who are so important that only the king is going to judge them.
The Fonthill case.
Yes.
Yeah.
The Fonthill letter is one of the very few sources that show us royal law in action in the Anglo-Saxon period. The letter was sent by Ordlaf, Ealdorman of Wiltshire, to King Edward the Elder to justify Ordlaf's right to give a five-hide estate at Fonthill to the Bishop of Winchester in exchange for other land. The rival claimant was a thane named Athelhelm Higa. To establish his claim, Ordlaf recounts the history of the estate going back to the reign of King Alfred. At that time, the estate was owned by a thane named Helmstead, a shady character who had been convicted of stealing a belt from another thane. The conviction meant the loss of reputation as well as a fine. It encouraged Helmstead's neighbors to pursue claims they had to his lands. One of those neighbors, Ethelhelm Higa, claimed Fonthill.
That must have been quite a belt. But seriously, why did this make Helmstead legally vulnerable for his real estate?
Most legal disputes over property in the Anglo-Saxon period were resolved by oaths upon relics that the property justly belonged to one of the two claimants. That personal oath was to be supported by a specified number of oath helpers who swore to the justice of the position. The enforcing mechanism was the fear of divine punishment for swearing falsely before God. A notorious character like Helmstead would have been hard-pressed to find people willing to swear to the justice of any claim he made, even if a court would assign him the right to make the oath. His only other option was to undergo an ordeal, which would mean reaching into a pot of boiling water to pick up a stone, then have his hand and arm wrapped with cloth. A week later, it would be unwrapped in front of the court.
If you plunge your hand into a cauldron of boiling water, it's not going to heal in a week's time. Were they looking for a miracle?
No. The burden of proof wasn't nearly that high. The hand and arm were examined to see whether they were healing normally or were infected. If they were healing properly, he had successfully passed the ordeal. But the judgment about this was to be made by the suitors to the court. In other words, guilt or innocence was a matter of public opinion, which presumably wouldn't favor a thief like Helmstead.
Okay. So how does the alderman come into this story?
Ealdorman Ordlaf was Helmstead's godfather, and so, of course, Helmstead appealed to him for support. Just by coincidence, King Alfred was at the time staying at a royal hunting lodge in Old Wardour near the estate of Fonthill. The ealdorman had access to the king and pressed Helmstead's case to him. Alfred was persuaded to allow Helmstead, quote, to prove his right. That means to defend himself in the legal proceedings. And Alfred selected several of his household thanes to hear the case. Helmstead proved his right to Fonthill by producing a royal charter, and the commissioners judged that he had the right to prove his just possession with a personal oath supported by a specified number of oath helpers. Athelhelm appealed the decision to the king. The letter writer described the scene, quote, "And the king stood in the chamber at Wardour. He was washing his hands. When he had finished, he asked Athelhelm why what he had decided did not seem just to him. The king said he could think of nothing more just than that Helmstead should be allowed to give the oath if he could. I, referring to Ordlaf, then said that he, Helmstead, wished to attempt it and asked the king to appoint a date for it, and he then did so."
So how did Fonthill become the alderman's property?
Because Helmstead, being a notorious character, wasn't sure that he could find the required number of oath helpers, and losing this case would put the rest of his property in jeopardy. So he struck a deal with his godfather that he would give him Fonthill if he found for him the oath helpers he needed. Ordlaf insisted this was not a bribe, as he truly believed in Helmstead's right to the property. The trial was held, the oaths were given, Helmstead won his case. He gave the land to the ealdorman, who allowed Helmstead to live on it for as long as he lived. That is, until Helmstead decided to steal some cattle. But that's another story.
Do we have any basis for comparing Alfred's enforcement of the law to other Anglo-Saxon kings, or is Fonthill such a one-off that we really don't know?
I think it's very difficult to tell. I mean, I think one of the interesting things is that in Alfred's law, it says anyone who betrays the king, you know, they're for it, they're going to be killed, you know, they're being sent into exile. But the one person who we know who seems to have done this, the Ealdorman of Wiltshire,
Wulfhere, Ordulf's predecessor,
he in fact is let off quite lightly. So I think there's this mix of the ideals of the law and the sort of pragmatism that Alfred has, which I think other kings would have as well.
You're right about the traditional nature of the law code itself and how it's sort of just tacked onto Ine's law code. What always struck me is how grand the prologue is. The preface that he wrote makes it sound like this is going to be a extension of biblical law to the secular people of Wessex. And it really isn't.
It's wonderful build-up, and you think, here is something completely new and different, and it's more cases of people who impale themselves on a tree that somebody else has knocked down, you know. And you think, is that it?
But is it also perhaps trying to say that disobeying the law code is in some ways against God's will?
Oh, yes, I'm sure that's the point.
Yeah.
That Alfred has been instructed to make, as it were, by his advisors, and that prologue of the law is a sort of beautiful thing drawn up by his great advisors at the court, and that perhaps they might have been a bit disappointed to find there's not more to it than
it's
that.
It's a theocratic kingship that the ideology, whether the practice is the reality
is
was or not, the ideology that Alfred was promoting was a theocratic kingship.
Yeah.
I mean, I'm here because God set me high.
Yes.
And
we're Christian people who are the heirs to Israel, and we're a new people of Israel. Again, it's a Carolingian motif.
It's very Carolingian.
Applied in England.
Hmm. And one suspects that the two Carolingians at Alfred's court, Grimbald and John the Old Saxon, are behind a lot of this ideology. And it is, I mean, it is impressive, but then when you get down to the Fonthill letter and you find a very dubious person is continually being let off their crimes because they're related to influential people at the court. Slightly worrying. But I do like the bit in the Fonthill letter where the Ealdorman, who's actually protecting this rather dubious person, says, you know, if we start questioning all the judgments Alfred made, when are we going to stop disputing?
Yes.
And that seems to me a slice of real life. And that seems to be Alfred, someone, attention to detail, someone who's on the lookout for cases he can intervene in and perhaps make a difference.
What I love about that letter is the image of Alfred in his chamber washing his hands
while
the Ealdorman comes in to plead the case.
That's another very vivid bit, isn't it? And those seem just more, so much more vivid and realistic than some of Asser's scenes, which Alfred does what is expected of him, whereas this document, which is a slice of life, is closer to what's going on and shows the problems of trying to introduce a sort of Carolingian ideology into the West Saxon court, which has to operate in a rather different way.
It also sounds as though, Asser briefly mentions but glosses over what sounds like some fairly significant resistance to the taxes, to the services, to the, what do you mean I have to ride out again?
I do wonder if Alfred wasn't really quite as secure as all these wonderful supports to his throne might suggest, that politically he was in a rather more insecure position while his nephews were alive and had their own supporters within Wessex and the fact that he could not go against their uncle, the Alderman of Wiltshire, who presumably was the one behind supporting their case. You know, when you think about things like that, perhaps Alfred just was not quite such a all-powerful king as he wants us to believe, as he wanted, or as Asser wanted his audience to believe.
Well, what I always loved was that Alfred, unlike Egbert, never declares himself to be King of Mercia, but he creates that title, King of the Angles and Saxons, which is including Mercia, but he doesn't take the title. He doesn't permit Ealdorman Æthelred to become King of Mercia, but he allows Æthelred and his daughter, Æthelflaed, to reign as if they were kings.
Yeah.
Very subtle and very political decision-making and diplomacy that's going on there.
I did want to ask, when Alfred first became king, were his nephews old enough to have been attractive military leaders at a
they were too young.
Time? Yes.
Yeah, they were much too young.
Yes.
So, it's obvious that Alfred was the choice. I mean, it's the obvious choice. He should have taken over at that point.
Exactly. But
I think that doesn't mean that those who thought they would benefit by the nephews becoming kings were prepared to let it go. And particularly as the nephews got older, they became a more viable alternative if people didn't like the Alfred model.
Especially at the death of Alfred, when the question, it's a real question. His nephews, Æthelwold has as much right to the throne as he does. Edward would have. They're both descended from Edward.
They're both throne worthy, but Edward was also, a grown man who could take over.
And so was Æthelwold.
No, but my point was, at least he was an adult. If he hadn't been, it could have gone back to Æthelwold.
I think the thing is that Edward had military experience, and if we go away from the Anglo-Saxon chronicle that we have, take a look at Æthelwold's chronicle, it looks like Edward was much more involved in those later Viking wars.
It's very weird that there's not more of that in the Anglo-Saxon chronicle. I don't quite understand what's going on there. But you do wonder if Alfred was very keen to get over an idea that he is the special God-given king.
Yes.
So his heirs should be the ones that succeed.
And also to make sure that Edward, as he got older, had every possible qualification to be the next king.
Yeah, I mean, that's right. It's much easier to set things up for someone like that. And I think probably the attitude of someone like Æthelred, the Ealdorman Æthelred of Mercia, and his sister Æthelflaed, that would be quite crucial, I think, in Edward's success, because Æthelred is a great warrior leader, I think. I think he's he is a very good war leader as well as Alfred was. And so have that him behind Edward that was a major success. And that's why I think Alfred has to walk on eggshells. He doesn't want to lose Æthelred. And Æthelred knows, he's beholden to Alfred, but he also knows he's got other people behind as he gets more and more successful in Mercia, that Alfred needs him as well as him needing Alfred. So it's a very interesting situation. And when you look below the surface, there do seem to be these sort of other tensions coming on, suggesting that Alfred's reign is a bit more interesting than just this wonderfully successful God-given king.
In light of what you're saying, it occurs to me it's a little puzzling that Æthelwold wrote so positively about Alfred, unshakable pillar of the people of the West, that sort of thing.
No, not really. I mean, by that time, the line of succession is firmly within Alfred's lineage.
Okay.
Æthelwold was descended either from Æthelwold or Æthelwold's brother, but he's descended from Alfred's older brother, King Æthelred.
Oh,
And he doesn't have any claim to the throne. He doesn't make any claim to the throne. It's all being done within this one lineage. So I think that Alfred...
So he was writing considerably later then.
He's too far out of it. He hasn't got a royal father or even a royal grandfather. And so he's just too far back. And there are probably other people around in Wessex who can claim a royal ancestor.
By that time, I think so.
Okay, returning to the Wantage statue's inscription, one last time, Alfred found the land ravaged by a fearful enemy from which he delivered it.
Well, He certainly got a good military reputation, although he didn't win all his battles by any means. But he won the ones that mattered, and I suppose that's what you need, isn't it?
I wanted to ask you about what could Alfred build on in Wessex?
Did
they have boroughs?
Yeah, I mean, I think, as I say, he's had this very powerful grandfather and father who really, his grandfather sort of doubled the size of Wessex by bringing in those southeastern areas that had been part of Mercia. And to do that and to set all that up, I mean, that has to be something that Alfred inherited that is going ahead. But I also think he's an heir of the Mercian kings in the 8th century, the great Mercian kings. Because, I mean, you know, kings know what goes on in other kingdoms. And so they're always on the lookout for what their contemporaries are doing or near contemporaries. So the whole expansion and clarification of royal rights that seems to take place in the 8th century, Mercia and perhaps in Wessex as well, is something that Alfred is heir to. And now there are sort of theories that one of the 8th century West Saxon kings, Cunewulf, may have built Wandsdyke reconditioned Wandsdyke. Andrew Reynolds has written suggesting that. And if it is, that suggests a sort of organisation of labour services and things of the type that Offa was able to use to build Offa's Dyke and to perhaps have garrisoned fortresses in Mercia as well. It may be that even in the 8th century, the West Saxons were perhaps copying Mercia, or perhaps they evolved together. And so that what Alfred inherited we just don't have enough detail to see it closely, but I think it was probably already set up to work quite well. And that Alfred redirected some of the labour services and things. And obviously he set up these very successful garrisons and a whole network of garrisons, which, you know, as you know, is the one of his great achievements. But I think he's adapting things that are probably already there or can be used, the certain rights that kings have.
Interesting.
Yeah, rather than sort of starting from scratch. And
so he's a systematizer, not an inventor.
Yeah, I think all kings are probably like that. You know, I think there's very few who come along and say, right, I'm going to do things totally differently. But they come along and they see what worked in their own kingdom, what worked in other kingdoms. And they go, well, let's modify things a bit. Let's try this. Let's, and that's the sort of thing. That's the sort of thing he's doing.
I think what allows him to do it is, well, the Vikings. I mean, that's you have a stress to the system, and Mercia disintegrated under that stress, as did Northumbria. For Wessex to survive, Alfred would have had to have whatever was available to him and to make it work as a system that would permit him to be able to wield power throughout the kingdom. As opposed to
having isolated fortresses on the borderlands. Yes.
Yeah. But I also think Alfred's a bit lucky in that I don't think Wessex is what the Vikings were most interested in. So once he could have a really strong resistance, I think they thought, well, what we really wanted was a route across to Ireland anyway, and perhaps the northwest will be better. We'll go and bother the Mercians. Yeah.
I'm sorry, I was just laughing. I was thinking of Americans and the American Revolution. Considering how much Britain had on its plate, we were perhaps the least valuable of the various territories the empire was.
What a mistake
we made.
Yeah. Well, sort of like swapping, but look at France, swapping all of Canada for a couple of islands in the Caribbean. In retrospect, maybe short-sighted, yes.
I have one last question. Alfred wasn't the great Anglo-Saxon king in later Anglo-Saxon period or even the Middle Ages, but he became that great man in the 17th, 18th century.
Yeah.
What do you attribute that to? Why did Alfred emerge as this hero?
Well, just because we knew more about him, I think. I mean, it's all down to Asser.
Yes.
I think, really. And so, of course, Asser was presenting this ideal Christian monarch, and it was based on studying the Bible and Latin learning and things. And this is what the medieval aristocrats, the learned people of the 18th and 19th century, also their learning was based on the same thing. So Asser was speaking to them. It made Alfred seem very contemporary to them. It was, something they could understand. Obviously, it was a bit archaic, and that was fine because he lived in the past, but it meant that they could relate to all these things that Asser was claiming for Alfred. And then because Alfred's really the famous, only famous Anglo-Saxon king, and all sorts of people for various reasons wanted to trace aspects of 18th century England back to the Anglo-Saxon past so that they could swank about how they were the oldest this and that in Europe and continuous monarchy and all the rest of it. And they wanted information with which to do that. And Alfred's the only reign for which there really is the sort of information that they wanted. So he was very adaptable. So he could look plausible as a statesman in the 18th and 19th century, and many of his ideals were those that people still professed in the 18th and 19th century, even if they didn't live up to them any more than probably Alfred did. But I mean, they were singing from the same hymn sheet, as it were. They recognized him.
The warrior intellectual was appealing to the Victorians.
Yeah. I always think the Earl of Wantage, who stood for Parliament, and he had been an officer in the Crimean War, and he'd been very badly wounded. And went through the rest of his life in considerable pain. And he put up the statue of Alfred in Wantage, and he really identified with him as a soldier who'd suffered for, and yet still gone on to do his all for the public life since he was an MP before he inherited all his wealth and title. And so someone like that could really think of Alfred in terms that they found inspiring, I think. This has happened to me, and this has happened to people in the past, and look at Alfred, he came through. And I think there could be that sort of degree of self-identification.
Yes.
As well as taking back all sorts of English institutions like the army, the navy, law, the professions. They could all claim, yes, we've had a representative in Anglo-Saxon England, and these are the foundations on which we built over 900 years, etc.
And a constitutional monarch who is a lawgiver. It goes back to that notion of the Norman yoke, and that if we go far enough back, we will find Parliament.
yeah, that's right. So all these great British institutions, they like the idea of antiquity, and Alfred, as presented by Asser, was the first.
Well, we are running out of time. Before we leave, I would like to thank Professor York again for sharing with us her time and expertise. It really was a pleasure chatting with you, Barbara, and I know that Ellen and I and our listeners have greatly benefited from your insights.
That's kind of you to say so.
We have one more episode in our Alfred the Great series, this one featuring one of the very best young historians of early medieval warfare, Dr. Ryan Lavelle. I hope that you'll be able to join us. If you are enjoying Tis But a Scratch, let your friends know about it, and good ratings and reviews really help spread the word. Bye for now.